I'm Colleen McNamara,
and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warriors Radio Network.
All right, joining me this morning is Joy Perrazzo, no stranger to the program, call sign Chick, and he is Mr. Warrior Passion. Joy, first of all, good morning. How are you, and thanks for doing this.
Good morning, Mac. No problem. My pleasure.
All right. The first of all, let's talk about, reintroduce you to everybody. Give everybody your background as an F-18 guy, and you got out of the Marine Corps as a major?
Yeah, that's correct.
Backbone of the Marine Corps? Yeah, just, I might add, backbone of the Marine Corps, just so everybody knows. Major.
Thank you.
There you go. There you go. We got to stick together. Nobody else thinks that, but, you know, if you don't think that, that means you're a schmuck. So we think that. Give everybody your path through the Marine Corps.
Joined in 1992, January, went to boot camp, came out a brand spanking new PFC, and started off in aviation back in the 90s in helicopters. I was a CH-3 Echo crew chief, who rocked, still getting the grease after me in the now. Yeah, joined MESAP, worked with college at USC, and then flight school, and flew Hornet for the remainder of my career, about a little over 14 years. And retired in 2014. So, yeah, 22-year period and all in pretty much in aviation.
Talk to us about you get out and what are you doing? Tell everybody what you do professionally, and also and you can tease our warrior passion discussion that we'll have here in a little bit.
Yeah, well, so my full-time job, what pays the bills, if you will, is I'm a contract flight instructor down at Miramar. I'm the site manager for the simulator, so still involved in training the Marine pilots to fly the F-18, which is nice. And then in my other life, I run a charity called Warrior Passion, where we reach out to as many service members as possible that may be suffering from either injuries or PTSD, and provide them with some recreational therapy. We do a lot of adrenaline-based events. We're really heavy into off-roading. We try to get as many events on the calendar as we can, and I've been doing that for about 2.5 years, and I'm going to keep it going.
Let me ask you something. How does that help you?
Well, you know, no matter which way you cut it, getting out there and staying out there, not only around our brothers and sisters that we've served with, is therapy in and of itself, no matter what you're, you know, and also partnering and reaching out and dealing with the civilian community. It's amazing to see all their support and love that they have for us. So it's just been a huge thing in not only my life, but everyone else that I've brought into it as well. So we'll keep it going and you know, see if we can keep giving back in any small way we can. That being said, though, there's still a lot to be done, you know?
No, you know what, Jordan? No doubt, but I'm a huge advocate for, look, there's a way to get through the darkness that you experience in your life, whatever, that wherever that darkness comes from. Some of it might be Marine Corps related, but you know what? A lot of it's not. And the way you get through it is by giving to others. And it, people look at me like, are you, and I'm not kidding one bit, and you're a great example of it. You and your wife and all the stuff that you guys have put together. I mean, I'm sure you have the same feeling that I do. Some nights you go to bed and you feel so good about the things that you've helped do for other people. I call it happy heart, man. It's like some nights you're going to float away if you don't tie yourself in bed because of the feeling you have. And I just, you know, I think you're a great example of it. And I just want to commend you and your wife and your whole crew for what you guys do, because honestly, I mean, changing lives, there is no greater life than changing other lives. And you're a great example of it. So nice going.
Well, I appreciate that, and also appreciate a lot of the work that you're doing, and we completely agree on that fact. I mean, when you can reach out and unselfishly just give, you gain so much in your heart by doing that. You know, it, just like with everything else, there's ups and there's downs. I mean, that's, so I just recently lost a combat injured Marine to addiction. So it's tough. You can't get through to everybody. But like I said, there's so much more work to be done. If anyone out there is thinking of volunteering or even starting a charity, please do it. The VA is swamped. They're overwhelmed. You can't just fix this with, you know, medication and a little therapy down there.
Right.
Just like we did in those foxholes, Mac, we, you know, we supported each other in combat. We've got to do that now that the combat operations have ended. And if you're thinking about doing something with your life, I think this is a great benefit to everybody, and you get a huge reward out of it as well.
The yesterday, the 3MF and the Marine Corps released a redacted report to the media. So the F-18 collision with the KC-130J over the skies off of Japan was in the news. And first of all, Drew, I want to thank you for doing this, because you know the instincts of most is to go silent and not talk. And what I like to do is bring somebody on and have them just explain to us, not to editorialize. And so that's what we're going to ask you to do. But I want to thank you publicly for doing this. And I guess the first question that I would ask and that I read was, can you explain how a squadron sets up in training for day ops and night ops? Is there a day crew? Is there a night crew? How is a squadron set up for training like that?
Yeah, how the squadron trains.
Yeah, I mean,
based on their training plan.
Yeah, because one of the findings that I read was that it was all captains assigned to working at night. Now, I don't know how a squadron sets up. Are there guys that fly at night? Are there guys that fly in the day? Does everybody do both? Could you explain how squadrons tend to organize themselves like that in training?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, all the Marine Corps squadrons build by what's called the TNR manual, Training and Readiness Manual. And just like when they're going through, you know, their first school, which is where I come in. I mean, I train them to what's called the level one codes in the TNR manual.
Right.
Basically comes out to a 60% qualified aviator, right? So when they get to the fleet, they're, you know, for lack of a better way to say it, about 60% qualified, and then they get the next 40% in their squadrons through the TNR manual. First stop along the way is what we call a wingman or combat wingman qualification. And it's just a series of training events that you need to accomplish, which include anything from air-to-ground, training with different weapons, different tactics, air-to-air training, some refueling, like during the day, during the night, night vision goggles, low-altitude training. And then, you achieve that goal, or that code, I should say, series of codes, get that qualification, you move on the next one. Which can then split off, you know, for flight leadership, either, you know, section lead, which is being able to lead two airplanes, to division lead, which is four, and then there are some also tactical qualifications. In schools, you can go to Top Gun WTI, which is run by the Marine Corps MOT, and some tactical flight leadership, like FAI, and some other qualifications, you know, FACA, and things like that. So we're constantly training throughout our careers. There's almost never a point where we stop.
Now let me ask you, George. This is not the training you're talking about. You're not talking about when you're part of the reg. You're talking about after you've completed the reg and you've reported to the squadron. Hello?
Yeah, Max, sorry. I think I'm losing you a little bit there.
Oh, okay. So the training that you're talking about is not done, you're not talking about at the RAG, you're talking about in the squadron itself after you report.
Yes, correct.
Okay, all right. So in the investigation, it talked about there was nobody above the rank of captain that was assigned to what they called in the article the night crew. Are squadrons typically broken up into that, or is that just simply those guys are working on night calls, so they happen to be flying at night at any given time, and that is a dynamic group? Guys will come in and leave that group. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, I can't go too specifically into the investigation because there's still parts of the investigation that are going on, but I can tell you some of what I've read. You won't find a single training readiness manual anywhere that says you have to have X number of majors on night crew or X number of senior guys versus junior guys. It just goes by the qualifications. So, for instance, you're never going to put a combat wing in with a combat wing in to go out and lead each other around. You're always going to have a section lead in there leading a wingman through whatever those codes are. Typically speaking, the next level code that you are, you can train one, I should say certification, flight leadership, you can train one below you. In other words, a section leader can take a combat wingman out and go fly and get a certain number of codes. Division lead can train a section lead, so on and so forth.
Got it.
So, yes, the certifications that you get, the qualifications, take time. So typically the more senior guys, the 04s, 05s are going to be your division leads and mission commanders, typically speaking.
Right.
But it's not uncommon at all to have, a couple of captains in the squadron that have that division lead four airplane qualification. In fact, if you look at the FRS, most of the instructors there are going to be captains. So rank really doesn't have much to do with it. It's all about the qualifications.
Got it. Talk to me about the responsibility of the flight lead and is it... I think we just lost them. So we'll call him back.
Mac, you there?
Yeah, just like in real life, comms sucks. All right, let me ask you another question. Explain to us the responsibilities of the flight lead. So in that context, when we're going up to train and you're going up to train me, do you sit down? Do you know my quals? Do you know the history of me? Do you know how good a pilot I am? Do I tend to know that based on reputation? What's my responsibility as the flight lead relative to you before I take you up in the air?
Sure, that's a great question. Yes, of course, you know the reputation. We all talk in, it's a pretty small core of pilots in that community. Before you even get to the squadron, all the pilots in the squadron know your reputation, know where you're coming from. Each and every flight lead is directly involved in training the leader, for sure. You know what to do, you know what their struggles may have been, what you need to do when you've got to accomplish that flight, specifically. But you're not going to have access to, the exact information maybe required of the schedules, right, would know, right, how many hours you have on night vision goggles or when your last night flight was. You may ask that in a brief, but typically there may be some details there that are not, brought out directly to the session leads.
Yeah, it does. I'm having a little problem with you, so I don't know if you moved or anything like that. But if you move, get your ass back to where you were. So let me ask you this. What's my responsibility as a combat wingman that you're training relative to what I'm comfortable with, what I'm not comfortable with. Is it my responsibility to look at you and say, hey, I've struggled with that? Is that a Bushido violation among pilots? We don't do that. What is my responsibility if I'm, if I struggle with certain things? Is it my responsibility to tell you that?
Yes. I mean, we'll ask junior pilots, and we know what they struggle with in general. It's not common for us to come up with a plan to create, a little extra training for them or whatever we need to do. As an aviator, though, you need to know essentially what you're qualified to do. In other words, if schedule comes out and you're on there for something that you're not current for or qualified for, then, yeah, you should speak up about that.
One of the things that happened in the investigation show was that he was signed off, or one of the pilots was signed off. Let me ask you a generic question. Signed off for like 6 training evolutions with a tanker, but when in fact only had completed 1. I don't understand that. Is that somebody gun decking a record because we want to get to other stuff and we don't think that tanking, merits that, and that is within my discretion? Is that outside the bounds? For instance, I mean, if you show proficiency after 2 attempts, and I'm grading you and you're good to go, is it within my discretion to sign off on the other 4 saying, no, he's good, and we can now use those flight hours to knock out all this other stuff that we evaluate as a higher priority? Is that within my discretion?
Well, I'd say it's kind of the opposite of that, actually. Like I said, I can't comment specifically on that investigation,
right.
At my level, we ensure that they meet all of the minimum training requirements and then some. And if they struggle during meeting those minimum training requirements, we'll actually give them extra training. It's not uncommon to see a student that struggles to get a few extra simulators, flex here and there. And we've even taken students and we've started them all the way through the program to give them a kind of second chance.
Got it.
Even though they've met the minimum training requirements. I've never known a squadron or anybody that's in the business of just signing somebody off and gun decking them, because that's your life. You can only rely on the guy in your wing with your life. I mean, there would be no way a struggling aviator would be signed off in that way. Like I said, maybe get some extra training out of it and highlight the areas that they need to work on, but signing somebody off that's not qualified is not normal practice.
Got it. Can you walk us through what's typical when, F-18s, a flight of 2, I guess that's redundant, but a flight, heads to a tanker? What is the sequence of events and how do they move?
Yeah, sure. Joining the tanker and refueling is considered administrative. It's standard.
Got it.
And we have our tactical portions of our flight, which occur in between the administrative portions. Takeoff, a landing, a tanker rendezvous, even the trap, landing at the boat is all administrative. I mean, it's the tactics we really focus on in training. 2, seeing that we, don't put emphasis and importance on the administrative, but it's standard. It's what I'm saying. In fact, if you you can look up the Joint Aerial Fueling publication on Google, and it's a NATO standard, so it's all over the world. We join the tanker the same way, we get gas the same way, the pump is the same. And I can walk you through a little bit of that if you'd like.
Yeah, would you just walk us through just the sequence of, the flight leader would join, he'd tank, you know, he, when he's finished, he moves here, dash two, then, you know, does this. When he's done, he moves here, and then they exit this way. What would just be, what would be normal when you, you know, if you closed your eyes and described it for us?
Sure, yeah. So, typically, you're more than likely going to be in formation. Sometimes you'll go to the tanker alone. We call that kind of yo-yo tanking. But typically, you're with a, you know, two airplanes, three or four, and you join the tanker as a flight. The tankers usually fly with following a racetrack pattern or an orbit pattern. And sometimes, if you're going overseas, they just fly straight for, you know, 8 hours. Or whatever it is. In fact, when I did a transpac from here all the way to Japan, it was, you know, two fun-filled days, or was it three, I can't remember, of, you know, eight or nine tanking evolutions over the Pacific Ocean. Typically what you're going to do is you're going to go out and find your tanker, okay? So finding the tanker is step one. Where is this guy? Well, he's in a known position, you know where that racetrack is, so you start heading that way. We use an air-to-air TACAN, which gives us distance and general direction that we link up with the tanker, so they can see us, we can see them digitally, right?
Right.
There's also some, you know, Link 16 MIDS, which is kind of like internet in the sky, if you will. So you can see where tankers are, surveillance aircraft, other flights, so on and so forth. We also have radar that we use, and we'll go find the tanker, lock him up, and be able to see what altitude, airspeed, aspect, distance, all those things are as we train the tanker. Now, we start training to a tanker rendezvous very early on in tour. So we have a very standard way to join the tanker. I mean, it's you come into the tanker. You typically will be 1,000 feet below the tanker's altitude, and you join low and on the left side. At about a mile, the tanker will have you in sight. They'll clear you up to their altitude, and what you do is you kind of climb slowly with a very, very safe closure rate and join up just off of their left wing. Okay?
Got it.
That is called the observation or port ops position. You're supposed to check to make sure that your radar is, you know, silent. You don't want to blast those guys and gals with a bunch of trons. And we also want to make sure that our switches are safe. So our nose is safe and we're not going to be, you know, dropping any ordnance or, you know, God forbid, accidentally squeezing the trigger with our gun loaded. That would be bad.
Got it.
In the grand scheme of things. So once we're in that port observation position, we're in, usually it's called an echelon formation. So we just kind of create a diagonal flow from just forward of the wing, kind of down and left.
Right.
Now, C-130 is usually somewhere in the ballpark, about 270, 280 knots, depending on altitude and what they're flying for that day. They're looking for clear air. You can do this during day or night. The altitudes vary. You know, they can be down in the teens or up in the 20s, depending on what you're saying to them. Very controllable. They fly a smooth platform. I mean, it's a giant airplane in the sky. And they're only going to use about 25-degree angle of bank when they turn, which is essentially, you know, very shallow angle of bank. So once you join up on the tanker, they'll clear you back there either one or two at a time. The C-130 uses a refueling pod on each wing, so they can refuel two aircraft at a time.
Okay.
So what they'll do is they'll clear either one or two back to what's called the astern position. We call that pre-contact, right?
Okay.
So it's usually you work your way down and behind the aircraft and position yourself behind the refueling drone. The KC-130 is a long, I think it's, I can't remember the distance, 60 feet or something like that, close with a drogue chute, which kind of this nice fluffy pillow out there just floating in the air. So the KC-130 and the KC-10 have those nice fluffy chutes, and then the KC-135, which I call a sick joke on the Navy Marine Corps, has a steel basket we refer to as the Iron Maiden. It's a 9-foot hose that you have to plug into and put a 90-degree bend in and fly formation off of that for, you know, 20-25 minutes.
Yeah.
And I've done battle. I've jousted with Iron Maiden and lost, so it's pretty bad. Anyway, it's you get into the stern position mid-clear for contact. You take your aircraft, nice controlled slow closure, 2-3 knots of closure into the basket. Make contact with the basket. You push the hose up until the green light comes on, and then you sit there and fly formation off of the tanker and get your gas. Okay.
Yep. How long normally does it take to retank?
Just depends on how low in gas you are. It can be a quick 5-minute plug. It can be a 10-minute plug. Sometimes, you know, it can take up to, like I said, about 20 minutes, just depending on what the flow is and how much gas you need.
Got it. All right. So, walk us through. So then when you're done, then what?
Yeah. So when you're done with gas, you communicate that to the crew, say I'm satisfied. And they say clear for disconnect. What you'll do is you'll back off nice and slowly using a closure rate. A V sub C somewhere in the vicinity of, 2-3 knots. Very slowly plug, disconnect your plug, go to the stern position. Once you're in the stern position, usually it's pretty much automatic. They're going to clear you over to their right wing. The right wing position is called the reform position or reform area. We call it starboard observation, we used to.
Right.
We make our way over to that wing, usually just forward of the wing, and then we reestablish ourselves in an echelon position.
Got it.
So, we're back in formation, and all we're doing is flying formation off of that tanker. And again, these are NATO standard procedures.
Right. So, the rest of us are just stupid. We've never done it. We don't know. We see pictures of it, but, you know, that's all we see is a static picture. If you were going to tank from the same hose, how do things change? If for whatever reason they didn't have two hoses available and you had to tank sequentially, explain where does dash two go, and then once dash one, finishes, where does he go, and then what happens?
Yeah. So if there's only one hose available, they'll clear one of the aircraft to the hose, and the other aircraft will stay there on the left wing, which is called the joint area or the port observation area.
Okay.
Until the other receiver, the other aircraft is done, that aircraft will move to the right into the reform area, and then they'll clear the second guy in to do the same thing.
Got it.
So once that's complete, that aircraft will move all the way to the usually to the outside of the other aircraft that's established on the right. In other words, join back up with the formation you were in before.
All right.
In an echelon.
All right.
So the part in the tanker, right? Once we're done and refueling ops are complete, we usually depart high and to the right. We'll do a climbing right turn. Getting away from the tanker's altitude. You can go level and cut away and then climb, but most of us will climb up and away to the right. So think of it as a flow, right? To join the tanker, you're coming in low and left. To park the tanker, you're coming high and right. Right? And just in case there's other aircraft out there that are joining the tanker as well.
Got it. That all makes sense. The, talk to me, Joey, about the one other thing that was prominently mentioned was the was Ambien. But so generically, I mean, pilots are pretty regulated in what they can have in their system. Any requests like that, go to the flight surgeon and whatnot. That's all pretty by the numbers. Yes,
it's all by the numbers. Not much information on that specific report for the mishap. I can only speak from personal experience.
I wouldn't ask you to speak about the report itself, but just generically, that's stuff. By the numbers.
I was specifically prescribed Ambien during a combat operation, which is very controlled. They can't fill. So they're never going to overprescribe it. You're never allowed to share it with your buddies. You're never allowed to take it under non-observed conditions. It's always going to be the flight surgeon and the CO that work together to prescribe that medication only when needed. In other words, you know, you're up all day planning for a mission, you're flying your mission, it's 7-8 hours at night, you come back, you debrief, and you need to get sleep again to do it all, you know, the next day. And that's when the Ambien comes in to help you, you know, get some shut-eye during combat operations. That's when I was prescribed it. I was never prescribed it during anything other than combat operations. Not saying that you can't do that as a squadron, especially when you're talking about some pretty intense training cyclic operations that are going, you know, hours and hours and hours. But typically, yeah, it's very controlled.
And so there's a deliberate process for that, which involves the flight surgeon and the commanding officer.
Absolutely.
Got it. All right. Yeah. That's really what I wanted you to describe and explain to us. Is there anything that I haven't been smart enough to ask you, Joey, that you want to make sure that people know about this?
Sure. Yeah. We always say in our community that joining and the tanking evolution is typically the most dangerous part of our flight. To be honest, I mean we can be ripping around at 300 feet at night, dropping bombs, but when it comes to tanking, think about a bunch of airplanes getting into the same piece of sky, doing a by definition dangerous operation. So the trick to staying safe is be smooth, you know, be on alert, and follow procedures. That's the biggest, I know. The thing I can say about that is we take it very, very seriously. Like I said, there's been plenty of mishaps. I've never heard of one in the last 30 years of a tactical aircraft hitting a tanker aircraft. But just to give you an example, in 2005, May 2nd, 2005, over the skies of Iraq, we had two of our F-18s collide after a tanker operation. So they both lost their lives, and like I said, we have a healthy respect in the Hornet community for taking operations. It's very dangerous, and you got to follow procedures.
I want you to clarify one thing, and then want to talk about Warrior Passion one more time before I let you go, because I know you got to go. Could you explain? You said that even though this part of the investigation has been released to the public, the investigation is still ongoing. What do you mean by that? What part of the investigation is still ongoing?
From my knowledge, anytime you have an accident, we're going to put together what's called an aircraft mishap board, an A and B, which finds the cause, basically what happened. You know, they dig into the records and release what's called an SIR. It's a report on the investigation. From what I've read, there are also some ongoing investigations which may or may not be punitive. So those can take a while. That's the reason I can't comment too much on this. So those investigations are still ongoing. I think if you read some of the articles out there, they indicate that, yeah, this is still under investigation. So you may see some punitive stuff come out of this. We'll see.
Got it. All right. I got an email. Let me read it to you. Hey, Mac. First of all, I remember hearing Joey before. Just want to say good on him, his group, his wife, and everybody who's a part of that. I think we have all learned from you here on Almarine Radio the power of giving. Certainly the power of healing that is in giving. How do we get a hold of him? Where do we find him? Do we just simply do a search on the internet for him? Joey, how does everybody find Warrior Passion?
Either through our website, which is warriorpassion.org. If you forget the address, you can just Google it. We're the first ones to come up, which is nice. We're also on Facebook and Instagram. So most of our events and all of our cool little pictures and things that we do is all on Facebook and Instagram. But if you'd like more information, check out our website, warriorpassion.org.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. If you search on Warrior Passion, it's the first thing that comes up. So well done, my friend. Well done. Anyway. All right, Joy, I know you got work to do this morning. Again, I want to thank you for coming on being a explainer in chief this morning. Certainly, we're all mindful of the tragedy that happened to six families and the F-18 and the KC-130 communities, and our hearts and prayers go out to them. But I want to thank you for explaining, you know, how this stuff works to the rest of us who don't really understand it. So thank you very much.
My pleasure, Mike.
All right, there you have it. That is Joey Perrazzo. He's a great dude. And check out what they're doing at Warrior Passion. It's really cool. And hopefully he and I get a chance to do some work together one of these days. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll check some news headlines, and then I'm going to share with you some audio from Viktor Frankl. So don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when the group can understand it. Good job, Matt.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I'll give you anything to feel it coming. Do you wake up on your own? I wonder where you are and live with all your faults. Up where you are, I won't say anything at all, so why don't you smile?
Just want to say thanks to Joey Perrazzo for coming on this morning. Yeah, most people you ask, they won't go near that. Even saying, hey, look, man, I just want you to explain to us. So, anyway, my thanks to him for doing that.
I won't say anything at all.
So let me read you some, before we get to the news, just kind of following up. Let me read you some of the things that in the article of note. All right, so... This is from the article that appeared in Marine Corps Times. Both Sean Snow and Todd South, who do a lot of the writing at Marine Corps Times, actually the two most prominent writers there. The pilot of the F-18 that actually clipped the KC-130J, right? Before that collision, he had flown 47 hours less than the 60 hours required by the Marine Corps Aviation Training and Readiness Logging System, known as Marine Sierra Hotel Aviation Readiness Program, or MSHARP. He only had 13 hours logged. So, I mean, that's a pretty poorly worded sentence. So what does it mean? So before the collision, he had flown 13 of the 16 hours, of the 60 hours required by the MSHARP program. Okay, December 6th, according to the investigation, the night of the crash, was the pilot's first exposure to a night tanker since his initial training. And that initial training was on July 7th, 2017. So what is that, a year and almost to the day, what, July to August, September, October, November, December. A year and 5 months previous to that was his first exposure to night tanking. The Marine captain was not qualified for night air refueling at the time of the crash. The pilot and his instructor had also incorrectly logged in training and readiness, that the pilot was qualified for night system air-to-air refueling despite having only completed one of six required night contacts with the fuel basket of a tanker. And so that was the question that I asked Joey, like, so is that standard? Here's the response, no. Is that standard, like, so he did this in once in July of 2017, so he's good, so we can move on to other things. Showed, you know, did it easily, whatnot. Joey's answer, no, that's not how that works. And then he made a comment like, look, you know, we bet our lives every time we go up there. You've got to go through all these steps. Here's a quote from the investigation. It looks like it's come from the Marine who signed off on his qual. If the pilot, his name is Resselard, demonstrated proficiency in plugging on the tanker, I probably decided to focus the remaining range / flight schedule time on other important training objectives. Conducting night intercepts, for example, may have been one of the training aspects I elected to prioritize over making repeated contact with the tanker basket, a Marine whose name was redacted told investigators. Yeah, according to Joey, we don't do that. Despite his lack of qualifications and experience, the squadron's night cell leader and pilot of Profane 1-1, which was the lead that night, requested Resselard and his F-18 make a, quote, non-standard echelon left movement following detaching from the refueling tanker. So what happened that night was, you heard Joey just talk about, if there's only one basket being used, right? The lead comes up and tanks from below. He tanks. Dash 2 is below him and left of him. The KC-130 is above him and to the right. So he plugs in, he gasses, and then he moves to the right of the aircraft and above the aircraft. Dash 2 comes in and plugs, right, and then moves after he's done, moves to the right, then they ascend and pull away. That's what Joey says is standard. It sounds like, it doesn't say in anywhere in the article which wing they were tanking under, but it sounds like the formation is to the starboard side of the KC-130, which is the right, and then the lead instructs Dash 2 to move to the left of the tanker. The article talks about it. Despite his lack of qualifications and experience, the squadron's night cell leader and pilot of Profane 1-1 requested Resillard and his F-18 make a non-standard echelon left movement following detaching from the refueling tanker. Okay, so that implies that they're tanking off the starboard side or the right side of the aircraft, all right? So it implies that Dash 1 is in his position, detached from the aircraft above and to the right. Dash 2's tanking, and as he detaches from the tanker and should join his lead, okay, to the right, okay, he's then instructed to move to the left of the tanker. Resillard, the pilot of the aircraft that would clip the KC-130, had not been previously briefed that he would assume this non-standard position, the investigation reads. As Resillard crossed over Sumo 4-1, which is the call sign of the tanker, from left to right, following the refueling, he lost situational awareness and abruptly corrected back towards the tanker, hitting the right side rear jump door of the KC-130J. And then the article goes on to say that the Marine spokesman says this, in layman's terms, the standard is for the receiving aircraft to move left to right when operating with the tanker, which is exactly what Joey just explained to all of us. And then they have the audio, which, and this is the sad, this is the sad truth of, and I'm going to tell you what another F-18 guy told me, last night. Here's the audio. They're going to fucking burn by both of us on each side? Question mark. The last transmission from Sumo 4-1 reads. It goes on. Dude, I was about to ask, like, can they do something cool like we used to do? Question mark. Nobody does that shit anymore. Never. I fucking like it, guys. Excited. What do you say? A left turn to, backwards, actually, this is perfect. So, do they have to course correct, blah, blah, blah. 12, right, which is the call sign of the aircraft that will clip the KC-130, right? 12 is crossing over the bottom from left to right. Oh, shit, they're going to do, it's actually she it, right? Which means that they're, you know, they're relaxed and they're going to burn by on both sides of the aircraft, okay? So, again, they're up there doing non-standard shit. Visual on one, there you go. And then the only thing heard after that is wind noise and hollering. And then after the KC-130J has been clipped. So again, from the article, which is, you know, this is all pulled out of a redacted investigation that Navy Times received. What it looks like is non-standard stuff, people going off the script that they're supposed to do. And six Marines are killed doing it. And you can hear the, you know, there's, and so I was talking to somebody last night, somebody who's seen post-traumatic winning. And one of the things I talk about in post-traumatic winning, the day the I didn't know this till General Milstead told me this, but he just said this recently when I was at Camp Lejeune doing it, and I invited him to come see it, and then he spoke at the end of it. But he stood up and he said, you know, and he's speaking to Marines of 2nd MA, and he commanded 2nd Marine Air Wing. So he stands up, and he's had a whole bunch of back surgery, so he walks with a cane now, but he's still the same funny guy, good dude. And so he stands up and he says, you know, one of the things Mac didn't know was that there was a LAV air defense variant embedded in with my company that day. Okay. Now they were going to be aggressed by different flights of Hueys, throughout the exercise that they were hanging out with us for. So they're talking on a UHF freak that I'm not monitoring, and I don't have a FAC with me. So the FAC's not monitoring me, telling him they're checking on. So anyway, evidently they made one pass, and the air defense variant guy said, we tracked you the whole way. And the response to that was, oh, yeah? Watch this. And so last night when we were talking, the Marine that I was talking to said, you know, reading that article reminded me of what you say in post-traumatic winning, which is what General Milstead told me, right? And it's just terrible, you know? 6 Marines dead. You know, 4 Marines dead that day. Why? Because we're fucking around? And, again, it's just quote-unquote non-standard. When you see that term, non-standard means we're going to fuck around. And, you know, it's the cost of it is terrible. But anyway, so I wanted to just finish up kind of the rest of the story, things that I would say that Joey Perazzo, you know, can't say, because of who he is and what he does. The other thing I would tell you is that there's an element of discipline. You know, I mean, we talk about it relative to ground units all the time, what it looks like. You know, but it's certainly, you know, it's no different in aviation units, right? Gotta do it by the numbers. Gotta do it by the numbers. And if you don't do it by the numbers, then this is the kind of stuff, that happens. And it's just awful. It's absolutely, positively awful. And so I can't thank him enough for coming on and talking to us. So what I want to do now is I want to take a break. Do I need to take a break? Yeah, let me take a break, and then we'll come back. We'll do just quick news headlines, and I want to share with you some audio cuts from Viktor Frankl. So, again, don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.